This is CliffCentral.com.
I'm thrilled to have Jeremy Thompson here, journalist probably most well known to South African audiences as the presenter on Sky News for a long time. Ever since I started watching Sky News, Jeremy was there. He was the host that sort of we watched at prime time in South Africa, and someone who conveyed the news to us for many years, an international take on the news, access to some of the most interesting people in the world, newsmakers, reporters, stories that otherwise we might not have had the kind of depth in understanding that Sky News gave us, and that particularly Jeremy Thompson gave us. And I remember you from so many different locations and places and spaces that it almost feels to me like I'm in the middle of a news broadcast when I see you. It's nice to have you here in South Africa.
Very good to be on the show. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you've written a book called Breaking News. It was published in October last year, and it seems to be one of those books that people are very interested in reading. I mean, you've had so many incredible experiences. And I opened up the book the other day, and it seems to me it's written for your grandchildren.
Yes.
Is that about right?
Yes. I mean, when I stopped full-time work at the end of 2016, at the end of that Trump election, which guaranteed that I'd did sort of go out with a bang rather than a whimper. I was wondering about writing a book, and very kindly a publisher mate of mine said, "You write it, I'll print it." And as much as anything, I thought, who's this for? Partly was for me, in a way, as a cathartic experience almost, to go back through a 50-year career in journalism and assess it, I guess, and put it down in one place and have a look at it. And the other thing I thought was, you know, my grandkids are now all moving into their teens, sort of know I'm on the telly, but don't really know the texture of it, the depth of it, where I've been, what I've done. So I've started off by imagining what they might be asking, you know, the things that they haven't got round to asking, because kids are always too busy to do those sort of things. So I want one day they have a book they can pick up and go, oh, that's what Granddad got up to. Good Lord.
Well, I think that's a fantastic love letter, but it's also it to me represents a space and time in TV news journalism, which is coming to an end in some ways. I think you were there at the apex, at the apogee of this, the excitement of live television news, at a time and in the history of the world where there was so much going on, and the chief means for ordinary people to access that information and to feel part of a story. And some of these stories are heartbreaking, and some of them are devastating, and some of them are inspiring, and it all depends on each in their own merits. But it really is a window, an archive, a time capsule, I suppose, of probably the most exciting time in television journalism.
I have little doubt that that's true, that, excuse me, that I was just lucky to surf in, from being a local newspaper lad, surf into this brand new world of broadcasting that started to open up in the late 60s and early 70s in the UK, which was driven largely by the BBC starting to open up local radio stations and national and regional TV stations. And I kind of surfed the wave and got into something I never thought I'd be in, really. I thought I was going to get to Fleet Street if I was lucky and scribble away on a newspaper, and ended up within a few years as a television journalist and becoming the BBC's first North of England correspondent, then joining ITN, working on the great News at 10. Those were sort of News at 10 on ITN, BBC 9 o'clock news were iconic programmes. Yeah. Because it was the days when everybody sat down at that time of day and watched telly. We snack on news and information 24/7, don't we? It's tapas out there. It's light grazing, whereas that was big, substantial, chunky bulletins at the end of the day. When we would go out sometimes for a day, sometimes for a week, and gather material and try and make the perfect picture, word, package. It was a craft. I mean, we saw ourselves as craftsmen, the crew, me, the reporter, the editor, putting together this package that would be compelling and riveting and would hopefully sum up a great story somewhere, and that people would sit down and go, wow. And I remember coming back with stories from, filing stories from South Africa, from Somalia, from Tiananmen Square, from the first Gulf War, the Yugoslav War. And if you got a real good one, an eye catcher, it was the days when your colleagues in the newsroom, when they watched that news at 10, would stand up and applaud what was a great piece of television that the team had put together. So, I mean, you're right, it was the absolute apex of television news reporting.
And, of course, you were the heir to the greats of British broadcasting there. Mm. The people who had carried the news during that time of World War II and of the Korean War and of, the fall of the Berlin Wall, which obviously happened during your time in television news and in radio news. Mm. And it's interesting to me that you started in radio. I have lots of love for radio. Radio Sheffield.
Radio Sheffield, which was one of the very early BBC stations to open up. In fact, I did a piece for them about 4 months ago, and it was the 50th anniversary of Radio Sheffield. I wasn't there quite at the start, but I joined in 1971 when I left newspapers after being an apprentice reporter on a newspaper. And Radio Sheffield, we did everything like you do on a good local radio station. You gathered the news, you wrote the news, you went to the police calls, you rang everybody, you put the news together, you got up in the studio, you read the news. Then you did the feature program. Then you probably did the phone-in. Then you did the debate program. Then you spun the disc. Then on weekends, I'd do the sports program with all the live stuff. And, you jack of all trades. So it's great.
But what preparation for ultimately what is probably the crucible of all of this put together when you're on live television and there's a breaking news story and it's of international importance and you're the person on the scene. And somehow I remember watching you, and you're able to fill that time that you're there when really the studio doesn't often know what else to do but to go to Jeremy. And you're standing in the midst of often chaos, trying to make sense of it, and filling that with useful information. It's something you can only do if you've learnt the hard way how to fill airtime with really great content and to make that content matter.
Yes, and as we all know, there are many days when there ain't a lot of content and you're still stuck in front of a microphone or a camera or whatever. And so you become adept at spinning and weaving any threads that, you can get hold of and turning it into a picture. So sometimes when a story in breaking news is perhaps marking time a little, you have to try and take it forward or at least give people backdrop. The background to it all, the texture of it all, the feel of it. So particularly, not only as a correspondent, when I became an anchor, I was sort of slightly reluctant about becoming an anchor after I had great years here based in South Africa and then the States, and I'd been in Asia before that. And my boss and an old mate of mine said in 1998, I wanted you to come back and start anchoring. And I said, well, here's the deal. How about I come back, but if there are big stories out and about, we go and anchor in the field, which was pretty new at the time, 20 years ago. So we shook on that, and that's kind of what I went and did. As often as possible, if there was a big story, I would go. So instead of having one correspondent there, you have the anchor. I was sort of a bit like being an orchestra conductor. You stand in the middle and you bring in the various instruments.
But that was quite revolutionary then.
I mean, it was.
I don't think it was done before you did it.
No.
Certainly the host was in the studio, the anchor, and they would manage bringing in different things and closing them up and then moving on to the next thing. But for you to do that in the field requires a whole different kind of dexterity because, as you say, you're orchestrating content from the studio, you're talking to people who are on site with you. You've got all kinds of technical challenges, making sure that everyone can talk to everyone and hear everyone. And you've got a developing story going on in the background.
Yeah, the first big test was in 1999, and it was the liberation of Kosovo. I'd gone in 91, straight after the first Gulf War, and gone into Yugoslavia at the beginning of the conflict, and then disappeared down here covered Africa and mm-hmm. covered the States. So felt like it was coming full circle to come in and almost wrap the story up. But I mean, the clever thing is that apart from us reporters and a presenter like me in the field, the bosses had had the wit to drive to get a couple, four satellite trucks driven down across Europe, very quietly and discreetly, and we tucked them away in various corners. So the, when the British peacekeeping liberators rolled over the border, and most of my colleagues from other networks were still arguing with the British Army media offices about who would be pooled and how we get the pictures out, we just drove in with our trucks, and within minutes of the liberation starting, I was going live from the first village with trucks running by, British Gurkha soldiers pointing at, you know, telling us to beware of booby traps. There was still blood drying in the houses. There were photos, you know, strewn across. You could see the sort of the moment, in a way, of the war. You could, there was so much to talk about. Kosovo Liberation Army soldiers walking down from the hills to claim the village after the retreat of the Serbian monsters, as they saw them, that they'd been clashing with. There was so much to describe. Meanwhile, the next truck was going further up the road with another colleague. As soon as I'd wrapped, he started broadcasting further up the road. They discovered the first sort of mass graves and so on. So we leapfrogged all the way up the road live all day. And it kind of did create TV news history. It blew away all our opposition, who hadn't expected it of us, and it gave viewers for the first time a real feel of being literally in the front line, of going in with liberation forces. They go into a country that we'd heard horror stories about, that hardly anybody had been in there. So it did change the way I think everybody did it. The other networks, rival networks around the world, had to reassess, and Sky had quite a struggle being recognised and taken seriously. You know, the old
Rupert Murdoch stuff.
Well, a lot of that, and I think Brits have been used to the appointment of view once a day news bulletin.
It was sort of a gentlemanly agreement that you'd watch the BBC.
Yeah. So who were these cheeky little upstarts that Murdoch had set up? You know, daring to go 24/7.
And of course, the resources that were put behind this. These are things that it would be a challenge for news networks today. And of course, you know, now there are so many other ways to gather the news with the internet and everything else. But at that time, to have dedicated the resources and to be able to have the right people in the field to be able to conduct the business of news reporting, this took some courage from the people at the top.
Yes, but I think it was, Sky was, you know, the cheeky newcomer and courageous at the start, and it was wonderfully set up by a lot of Antipodeans, who we called the marsupials, who were, you know, much more gung-ho and much, you know, than the good old straight Brits. So we kind of harnessed the British journalistic nous to the go-get-em Wild West pioneering spirit of the marsupials, and between us, we basically created something that was, you know, I mean, it was very management-like. The people at the top of Sky in those days used to say, yeah, go for it, boys. You know, get out there. You know, conquer the world. Right. Give it a go.
But that pioneering spirit.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah, it was. You know, like the days of pioneering across Africa and so on. It was go out and give it a go. So we went out and gave it a go. And there were fewer rules and, you know, it wasn't quite as sort of straight-laced.
It was probably a lot more dangerous because there wasn't, in every situation that you entered, there wasn't always that agreement that you would be protected. And because you sometimes went outside of the protected scope of where journalists should be allowed and, you know, what pool they should be in and whose authority they should be under the aegis of, it does put you in the position sometimes where you're in the crossfire. And I've got to refer again to the opening of your book, where you basically start off with a little extract from what you would have said to your grandchildren. I just want to read this because I think it's a great exposition for some people of what precisely they'll hear if they go into the book, and it's worth getting into the detail of these stories. But you summarize quite nicely. I went to more than 20 wars, several civil conflicts, a few coups d'etat, far too many terrorist attacks, and at least one genocide. I've been caught up in massacres and gunfights, seen natural disasters, floods and tsunamis, hurricanes, tornadoes and monsoons, earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, drought, famine, plague and pestilence. I've witnessed a few man-made disasters, exploding factories, poison gas clouds, mining accidents and shipwrecks. I've told tales of crimes almost too awful to recount, serial killers, child abductors, and I've even talked to murderers. I mean, that, and I'm sure you could have gone on, because there's more experience than you could fit into that paragraph. But that seems to me almost like the epitaph of the great journalist in some ways. I mean, that's what you couldn't have wished for more.
No.
To have experienced all of that. But at the same time, there was an element of having to go through the hard yards of learning to write, then learning to do radio and explain what's going on in words, this time vocally, then having to do the television hard yards. And all the while, you were dipping back into other things as well. It wasn't as if it was a straight path, and it wasn't as if you were just lucky, and it wasn't as if you could only work hard either. It was this amazing combination of factors that delivered to you this experience, which is insurmountable.
I look back at the end of it and think, I have been incredibly lucky. I'm incredibly lucky to do all that when I set out not expecting to do it. Incredibly lucky at times to fall on a story. I mean, I've come to South Africa to promote a book, and you've probably got the best political story since I was down here 25 years ago. So that's not a bad story. I'm not actually covering it as a day-to-day journalist, but I'm certainly enjoying it and weaving it into the sort of book experience. But I, in all honesty, when kids now say, "Whoa, how did you get all that?" I said, "I followed my nose. I mean, I just kind of followed my nose. I didn't do anything terribly smart or clever. I went into newspapers because I wanted to be a journalist, and kids like me were never going to get into those posh places like the BBC or whatever. And then the BBC did open up, and the hoi polloi were allowed in there. So we went and sort of, you know, mounted the ramparts and clambered in and made the most of it. And suddenly you learned local radio skills, and somebody from the regional telly said, "Oh, you look a likely lad, come up and have a trial with us." You get into local telly, and then BBC in 1997 decided that they really need the North of England correspondent, because ITN had one and they were beating the backsides off them at most stories, so they decided to have one, and I got that. And then I jumped ship in 82, and I mean, most of my friends at BBC were completely aghast when I said, "I've decided to go and have a go. ITN's got a sports correspondent job coming out. I thought I'd go and have a go at it." And they went, "You crazy, you're mad. Why do you want to go?" I said, "Well, sport is news. I'm a newsman, but I love sports, so I'm going to go there and do news sports stories." So they all thought it was absolute folly. And I saw it, like you do, full of bravado. You go, "Well, you know, you just watch. I'll make you eat your words." So they said, no, you're crazy. I said, "Ask me, if you can find me, ask me at the end of this year, 1982, where I'm going to be." So I thought, better go out and do so. Anyway, within a month, I'm here in South Africa doing the very first Rebel cricket tour, led by Jeff Boycott.
Was that your first time in South Africa?
Yeah.
Right.
So 36 years ago, which is almost the month. And that was quite an eye-opener, and it sort of started my love affair with South Africa, and I wanted to be back. It took me another, you know, good few years, 9 years, before I was based back here. But by the end of that first year, 1982, I was actually in the middle of a three-month stint in Australia, a sports correspondent covering an Ashes cricket tour, and also trying to do, because I'm a newsman, every other story that came up. So I did drought in the outback, and I did, you know, dwarf throwing, and I mean, all the sort of weird and wacky stories, you know, kangaroo racing, anything that cropped up, really. Floods, feasts, famine, and a lot of cricket. I mean, 3 months of it. So actually, when friends sort of got in touch with me on New Year's Eve, I was drinking champagne, Aussie champagne, sitting in a swimming pool overlooking Sydney Harbour, and in between, just about to go and do the next test match. So, in Sydney.
You won.
No, it was, I won the bet. England was shockingly bad on that.
No, I'm not talking about the cricket.
No, we won one test out of the five.
We're not even talking about cricket in South Africa at the moment.
No. Well, I'm not talking about rugby in England after the weekend. That was a bit of a setback. Anyway, yeah, so I followed my nose, and then the next thing that cropped up a few years later, I had a wonderful time doing sport and went all around the world, did Olympic Games and Ashes cricketers. I ended up going to India when Indira Gandhi was assassinated, simply because I was the only guy with an Indian visa in the newsroom. So I, you know, they said, get on the plane, Indira Gandhi's been assassinated. I was visaed because I was going to go and do a couple of England test matches out there. And I ended up coming back home 3 months later, having done a cricket tour, the aftermath of Indira Gandhi's assassination, sort of, you know, riots in the streets of the capital, New Delhi, the assassination of a deputy British High Commissioner in Bombay. I went to Bhopal to do the Union Carbide disaster. I mean, yeah, all right. In name, I was a sports correspondent, but
you would, here you were as
well.
I
remember going to sports events where, you know, there'd be some huge disaster, and the Times would ring its football correspondent, say, "Oh, there's been a terror attack somewhere," and they go, "No, dear boy, I'm a football correspondent. You must send someone else to do that." So it was the days that, so some like me was a bit of an all rounder and was willing to give everything a go. It was great. I ended up doing the election of Rajiv Gandhi. We actually won the test series after losing the first match, and I'd done crime, riots, conflict, a sort of mini war, a industrial disaster on an epic and horrific scale, an assassination, a political campaign, and a few test matches. So the chapter is called Indian All-Rounder, and I kind of was, really. That's what, you know. So not surprising, you build a reputation where bosses think, "Oh, send him, he'll do everything."
Well, I don't want to labor the point, but what you've just illustrated in your Indian experience is precisely what I think not just journalists want, but most people mark their lives by the news events that they live through. And here you are not just marking your life by these events, but actually delivering them to all of us. Mm. There must be a feeling of, and it must be difficult to remain objective and to be steady in those situations where you're actually in the middle of something that's happening that you know has massive ramifications for the world. And when you talk about assassinations or elections or wars or any of these kinds of things, it's hard to not inject yourself into the story, but at the same time, after the story, it really does. You do own a piece of it.
You do. I mean, without a shadow of doubt, 4 years based here in South Africa in the early 90s, watching from Mandela coming out of jail through the sort of the birth pangs of a new democracy and the death throes of apartheid was unbelievably compelling drama. And to be part of it, to be lucky enough to be here at a time like that, to see the most extraordinary things, to be an eyewitness and a chronicler of that extraordinary piece of history that I never, when I was a few years before that, I would never have believed that would happen. I never thought I'd see the end of the Cold War or the troubles in Northern Ireland, and I certainly didn't think in my lifetime I would see the end of apartheid. So things came rushing along in a way, and things did change, and suddenly you're the guy standing there on the front line. So don't let people down. Do it justice. I mean, think what happens over, which is crucial in those days, and which I think is harder in the social media and digital age, is to build up a body of work where people, I think you build up credibility and you build up trust. So people say, there's that guy, Jeremy Thompson, he's out there again. I've watched him for a long time, and I think he tells us as good a truth as we're going to get.
And this is the antithesis.
And I trust him. That's the key thing.
This is the antithesis of the fake news problem we have now, right?
Very much so, yeah.
You solved that problem because it was a different time, different medium.
Mm. And I think it's going to be harder and harder now. I think fake news is a threat,
yeah,
as is the whole sort of digital age the immediacy, the warp speed factor, which fact or non-fact is being hurled at you and in bite-sized pieces.
Does it frustrate you also that, and I don't know how much of a problem this is in the UK, but it certainly is a problem in America and to some degree here as well, is that people live in these echo chambers where they're only actually hearing the stuff that confirms their already evident views?
Yes, much more so. I think it allows that. It facilitates that much more. I mean, I think people have always liked to hear, you know, in Britain, broadcasting is regulated very heavily by Ofcom. So I can't go out there and give my views. I can invite somebody in as a guest and we label what they are and they tell their views, but we can't. But a newspaper doesn't have any of that regulation. So people pick up a daily newspaper because it chimes with their own view, whether it be left
or
right or centre.
So you're a Guardian reader or you're
exactly.
A...
Right. Yeah. And so broadcasting has always been, you know, you get pretty severely whacked across the back of the hand with a ruler if you're out of line, you know, if you do anything. In fact, I think the pendulum swing's gone almost too far, where I worry now that stuff that I would have got on air when I was in Africa, I mean, the genocide in Rwanda, I mean, nowadays, 75% of the pictures I got on air 20-odd years ago would not get on now. I mean, we've gone into an age of sort of relentless, as you say, echo chamber information or non-information.
It's a little, don't you also feel it's a little watered down and,
yeah,
and weakened? And there's
timid.
This idea of
timid.
Timid is a very good word. And the idea of this false equivalence, that you have to always represent two sides of an argument, even when there isn't another side to an argument. I mean, there isn't a side to genocide, for example, where you want to side with the genocidal maniacs.
Well, there is, interestingly.
Is it hard? What I'm asking is, and this is probably, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but probably at the crux of why you were able to do what you could do for so long. How do you know when you're being as objective as possible? I mean, how do you figure that out in the heat of a story?
Yeah, no, it is hard. I hope that the training stands you in good stead. The fact that it was sort of beaten into you as a youngster, as a young journalist, that you had to check facts, that you had to get as many sides of the story, you had to be balanced, and if you couldn't get all sides of the story, explain to people. You know, I always felt as a broadcaster, to be honest with people, trust the viewer or the listener to come with you on the journey, and if you make a bit of a mistake, tell them you've made a mistake. If you tell them, I can't get hold of the other side, so I can't give you as balanced a view as I like, this lot is saying this, but the other lot are over the other side of the green line and firing at us, I can't actually go and talk to them right now, then I think people understand. If you try and con them or tell them half a story and try and wing it, then you start to undermine your credibility and the trust the public have in you. And I've always have a view that the public is largely viscerally quite sharp and kind of can tell whether you're hamming it up, whether you're telling the truth, whether you're playing games. As said, I mean, you know, I think broadcasting's all about honesty and straightforwardness and taking people with you, trusting them, and they hopefully will trust you and you take them on a journey. And we take them in more recent years much closer to things than they would have ever been to before. Although that's now getting difficult because of situations like Islamic State, those are things where you can no longer just walk into a conflict and report it because
you yourself
it's a death sentence, yeah. Really. So it's now becoming very third hand. So in a way, some of the events, you're being moved further away from those front row seats.
Well, of course, unless it's someone in there with a cell phone recording things, which is always interesting because there are a whole lot of new parameters that come into play. Let's talk about South Africa, because you were here in those foundational years. I had Alistair Sparks, who's one of our real doyens when it came to... I had him in here last year before he died, or 2 years ago. And he explained to me that his frustration was that through the long lens of history, everything is actually quite stable. But in the moment, Cyril Ramaphosa announcing his cabinet... Jacob Zuma resigning, this is all so dramatic. But actually, if you have 30, 40 years, as you do, of experience in the news media, you tend to have a lot more stable an approach to how to handle these things, that not everything is a drama. You know, ordinary people around the dinner table are saying, oh my God, it's a crisis, or this is nothing really. When you,
I slightly disagree there. See, when you come to South Africa, I actually do think everything's a drama. I think you're a wonderfully dramatic race. Yes. And you've been through a hell of a lot. And it's what, and you know, we've been, my wife and I have been down here sort of staying with friends and going around for the last 2 or 3 weeks as we normally do around this time of the year. And the things that have happened and the things that have happened publicly and privately and so on, I think actually this is a country that loves a drama. So good old Britain, I mean, we're such an ancient democracy that we bumble along and everything's a bit understated and a bit slightly ironic and, well, you know, it's, you know, Britain could blow up and people would still say, oh, it's only a scratch, dear boy. Whereas here, it is a drama all the time. It was always a drama all the time I was here before. And this last week or so has been a drama. And actually, the events of the last 9 years have been a drama. I mean, you love the big highs and the depths of misery and despond.
Yeah.
And the euphoria again. I mean, you know, Rugby World Cup 1995, the most euphoric moment for many South Africans they're ever going to see, probably. Following on from only a few months before of sort of the despair and despond of, you know, the
Chris
election.
Chris Hani's assassination.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, all the things that I reported on during the early 90s. I mean, how you ever fell over the finish line on that election day in 94, goodness only knows, because it wasn't really meant to happen. And I was, you know, I saw the blue touch paper being lit numerous times only for somebody to stamp it out just before the fireworks box went up. So, I mean, it really was a miracle you got that election.
Well, I'm interested in your observations of that time, because I'm sure you recall them with clarity. I mean, it certainly appears from your book that you have an incredible memory for events and for people and for places. What objectively as possible, because you weren't, South Africans tend to feel a greater share in ownership of this story because it's ours, but it was a world story. And for you to come in from outside, even though you'd been here before, and to be present for those seminal events, can you just take us through it as vividly as you remember it? Because I think a lot of South Africans have forgotten
that it was one hell of a roller coaster ride for four years. It was the biggest roller coaster ride that most countries are ever going to go through. It was highs and lows coming thick and fast. And, you know, when I think of, you know, the moment Mandela walked out of jail, February 1990, I was reporting the reaction of the ANC in exile in Lusaka in Zambia, where they didn't react quite as we had expected, to the point we actually, a few of us in the media, actually sort of helped lay on a bit of a party so they really could look like they were as excited as we thought they should be. But I think they just were a bit distanced from the atmosphere
who
here.
Who was there that we would know?
There were people like Alfred Zoe. There was Paulo Jordan.
He was known for being a bit sleepy.
Mac Maharaj, there was a host, you know, a host of people. It was, you know, the exiles.
Sure.
You know, either the islanders, the exiles, or the internals. And that was the, you know, the outsiders, the exiles wing. And 4 years later, of course, I'm standing on the steps of the Union buildings waiting for the Rainbow Nation speech. And, you know, here are the same gang of people now in very, very snappy suits and getting ready for government. So, I mean, it was an amazing journey for them as well as for us covering it. But I got here in time for the start of CODESA and everything looked quite promising. And then events would happen that would derail it and there would be another disaster. You know.
And the right wing would storm it.
Yes, yeah, so that was sort of quite bizarre. And they, in the end, got their comeuppance in Bophuthatswana. So,
right.
But no, much more of a threat were things like the Third Force and Boy Patong in June 92, which was horrendous. And we went there, you know, within an hour or so of getting the news of that happening. I mean, that was the first time I really seen Mandela, who was this charming man, you know, suddenly the steel came through, and he had a serious go at FW and said, you know, if this is your third force, you're behind this, you know, if you're going to behave like this, then these talks are off. They managed to keep them going somehow. Cyril Ramaphosa, Rolf Meyer, you know, who became mates and sort of kept driving this process along, even when the big figures were, you know, sort of bashing each other with words and rolled up newspapers or whatever. And then a couple of months later, me and my crew and a few others are in Bishu when 50, 60, 70,000 ANC people led by Cyril Ramaphosa, Ronnie Casserolles and others march up the hill to try and persuade Brigadier Obakoza of the Siskai homeland to stop supporting the white government and come and put his weight and his troops and his people behind the ANC and get on side. And we walk in with the march and his troops open fire on us, much to our disbelief and horror, as well as everybody else there. I think when the first fusillade went across, we thought they were just firing over our heads to frighten people. But when people started dying around us and we're tumbling down a hillside and, you know, in amongst people alive and dead, it was pretty clear that he was serious. He wasn't going to put up with these ANC people marching over his border. So it was a pretty horrendous eye-opener to the tensions and the obstacles that were still in the way of the democratic process. And again, the talks nearly broke down.
And of course, again, an illustration of how much more complex so many of these stories really are. When people think that a story is very bipolar and it's very easy to read it, binary is a better word, and you end up hearing these stories again, many of these stories are forgotten now, or at least pushed to the back of a footnote of history. And to me, to have heard you explain how it felt to be there, again, adds...
The next day at Siskai, they brought Mandela down to look at the scene, and we're all rolling the cameras, and he leans over and points at me and said, as he always did in his extraordinary charming way, "Hello, Jeremy, how are you? How's your family? You were here yesterday. Tell me what happened." And I'm suddenly Mandela's eyewitness trying to explain this awful scene. So you really do, you know, in occasions like that, get drawn into the story. You've become almost part of the story. So it was intriguing. I mean, he told me many years later when we sort of sat down and had a cup of tea down at Houghton at the foundation in his office there, that the foreign correspondents had played a very significant role in enabling the change in South Africa, because we'd kept the story alive in the eyes of the world at a time when the eyes of South Africa weren't seeing most of it. And that had kept up pressure from governments outside, it kept up the pressure of sanctions and so on, because we were still informing the outside world. So he was always complimentary and grateful for the role that foreign correspondents had played. And he did call us all by our first name, remarkably. Because, you know, in the 80s when I was here, and even into the early 90s, I mean, most South Africans weren't seeing those pictures.
No.
Because there was censorship. In those days, we used to have to take our tapes up, our finished stories, up to SABC at Auckland Park and kind of give them over for them to be put on the satellite by censors who could press the button and eject it if they didn't like what they were seeing and hearing. So it was quite difficult getting the real story out there. And some of my camera and I work with would say that certainly in the worst days of the late 1980s, they would film stuff in townships, confrontations with the police and, you know, protesters, Soweto and many other locations around the country, where they'd get home and, you know, have a braai with neighbours or friends or sometimes relatives, and they'd say, "What do you do today?" And he'd tell them, cameraman would tell them, and they'd say, "Well, you're a liar. You're a, you know, you're a propagandist for foreign government. Yeah, you're an agent. These are lies. It's not on our television." Well, it's not on your television because it was censored. Government didn't allow it to go out. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people worked for a long period of time in the media under considerable pressure, like the people who were trying to change the country politically, just to get those stories out there so the world did actually get a clear picture of what was happening. So it was interesting times.
And looking at South Africa now over the period of your time on Sky News, since those early years of the 90s where you were on the scene of the crime and you were here to observe firsthand what was going on, to see how that evolved, did you have feelings about what was happening in South Africa post-democracy? I mean, certainly many of us had high hopes and aspirations for the country in the beginning, and then things started to change a little bit, and they went a little awry. And now a lot of people are filled with what seems like a sense of renewed hope. How do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, the country's very dear to my heart. I spent a lot of time here. I saw the blood, sweat, and tears that were spilled by people to win that democracy. And I've come back, almost every year for the last 20 years on holiday, and then I came back and followed the latter months of Mandela's life, and I covered the funeral and was in Kunu for that and followed the Pistorius trial. So, and I've still got a lot of friends here, and a lot of them, from all sides of the spectrum. Some of them were involved in the struggle and have been increasingly frustrated and disappointed by the sort of failure to move forward at times. My view, from a slightly more distant point of view, is that, kind of what you expect. It's only 24 years since you won democracy. It's very young in the scheme of things. Britain's had a democracy for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we still make mistakes. So it's not a perfect way of managing the society in which we live. It appears to be one of the better ways of managing it, and it's probably largely better than a despot or a dictator, but you kind of have to work it out. When people said, but they're all corrupt and it's terrible, I said, who do you think they learned from? They weren't clean before. I've just been down the bush and we were going along what was, right out in the bush in Sabi Sands in the Mpumalanga, some of the old railways. The tracks have gone now. You follow game down, track game down these old railway lines. And when we looked it up, it was railways that had been built a century or so ago when mining was starting up and so on. And some of the railways were never completed because people started ripping off the government. And,
more things change.
I was going to say, really, get real. Things aren't perfect. Don't move forward as you'd like. What I've always been disappointed for was watching how much people put into winning that democracy. I said literally spilling blood for it. To have that disrespected, as I think has happened in recent years, is desperately disappointing for everybody concerned. The people of South Africa, I think, are wonderful people, very resilient, very long-suffering, very patient. They put up with waiting for change for 300 years. They finally get it, and it's not perfect. And it hasn't quite got off to the start you'd hope for. But to see the efforts they made to win democracy being disrespected and being undermined is sad. So I could sort of understand the excitement and the optimism a week back when Ramaphosa is sort of named as the new president. And I think there will be a decent honeymoon period. I mean, he's not perfect himself, but he's been around a long time. He knows how the system works. He knows where some of the skeletons are buried. He knows a bit of everything. He's worked in business. He's worked as a politician. I'm sure Mandela would have been keen for him to become the successor. Didn't quite happen that way. So maybe he is the right guy at the right time. And I think people are so relieved there's been a change, they'll give him 100 days plus to get things moving. I think you've been marking time for the last few years.
There's so much I want to ask you. Your book alone is filled with stories of danger and of kind of daring do, for want of a better word.
Foolhardiness at times.
When you go to places like Kuwait, in the Gulf War, and you mentioned Kosovo earlier, and you talk about all these natural disasters and things. I mean, how many times have you actually felt, oh my God, I might have gone too far, I might be in real danger. I might need to call my wife, call my children, say goodbye.
Never quite got to that. There've been enough hairy moments to think twice about how you approach it the next time. I think I've been lucky enough always to work with people who had their heads screwed on right, and I think it's useful in a television team that there are probably two or three of you, and that you work it as democratically as you can, and when you come to a fork in the road, you have a chat to the other guys or girls, whoever's on the team, and say, left or right, you know, what do you reckon? We try and figure it out.
I mean, you were in Namibia with Angola, with executive outcomes. I mean,
yes.
These dangerous sort of mercenaries, right? I mean, these are the kinds of stories that you'd expect in a fictional book.
Yeah. Or flying in to talk to Lakama when he was one of the most wanted and feared men in the world when he was running Renamo. And we flew in sort of illegally and hedge-hopped in on a plane that shouldn't have flown into a jungle clearing and went and got an interview with him and toured around the area with him. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to put your faith in humankind and hope they're not quite as bad as they're written up. You know? But, yeah, Somalia was hairy. Rwanda.
How do you even manage to make the studio interesting after you've been doing these things? I mean, you're sitting in Sky News in West London.
Yeah.
And you probably had this, this burning desire to be out there where things were happening. Sometimes you couldn't be.
True. It was quite difficult. I mean, I still think, you know, you get into journalism because you're nosy and you're curious and you don't like taking no for an answer. So, you know, you're that irritating kid that the parents go, oh, you know, shut up for a minute, son, you know, rather than why, what's going on, what's happening, why, I need to know. So if you've got a child like that, let him go into journalism, because they're probably gonna, it's the only way to shut him up, to for them to go and get the answers to why and who and where and what. But no, I mean, I think that instinct, that curiosity about the world stands you in good stead in the studio. But you know, this for me, it was the irony is, it's where you become best known. For me, in job satisfaction, it was one of the least satisfying things, because I liked being a reporter out in the field, so I tried to get out as much as possible. So I'm always a bit, you know, slightly saddened when youngsters come up and they're coming to business and you go, well, what are you hoping for? And they go, oh, well, I want to do what you do.
I want to be on TV.
I want to be. And I say, what do you think I do? Well, you're on TV and that's all that matters. And you say, and they'll say, well, how long did it take you to get there? And I'd say, well, about 30 years, you know, about 30 years of learning to be a decent journalist. Oh, no, I'm not going to wait that long. So they really want to, you know, there are a lot in this journey who are brought up the belief they want to be on television. That's really important. I didn't want to be a celebrity. I didn't necessarily. The being on television was the least important bit. It was, I liked the medium of delivering my bit of journalism with the help of camera and words. I liked moving pictures and words and finding a way of marrying them together and weaving, you know, a story with texture and depth that people would enjoy and would give them a feel of what that story was all about. That, to me, that's the most important thing. So I think I've headed up one of the chapters. It's not about me. And I would still say that to all kids in the media. It's not about me. Don't stand in front of the story. There's a nice story behind you. Get out the way and tell it. Let your public see that story. Helped deliver it. You are just a messenger, a chronicler, a medium for delivering that story. So do it as best you can. Do it justice. Respect the people who are watching or listening. Tell them that story. But for goodness sake, don't stand in the way. But there is definitely a drift in television news around the world that, to make it more interesting, you know, let's big up the anchor or the correspondent, and it suddenly becomes all about them. And I said, I would just hammer away, it's not about me.
Well, I mean, you're a great writer and the book is terrific, and you make no bones about the fact that your love is the story.
Yeah.
But it does seem to me, with a lot of television these days, it's really about almost putting pop stars up and getting them to read a script. And so much of the news, I'm certainly not saying any particular network, but so much of the news these days is just delivered by a talking head. And you can hear it in the questions that they ask of the reporters on the scene of some breaking story. And you can also see that they don't really care about getting the information. Sometimes it's just about filling the time.
Yeah. I mean, if you haven't been out there at the sharp end of news gathering.
And they're very pretty.
Yeah. But they, you know, why would they know particularly about that? I mean, Sky employs journalists. We don't, you know, the old days, the BBC, when it was an actor reading the 9 o'clock news in a very posh voice and a lounge suit, have gone at least. But a lot of those younger journalists won't have had the body of experience that I've been lucky enough to have over the years. So they don't really know often what it's like at the sharp end. So they're not going to necessarily know, understand entirely what the correspondent's going through, or maybe the nuances of a story like that. So, yeah.
Well, what's it like working at Sky News? I mean, what time do you arrive there when you were doing the afternoons? You'd arrive, what goes straight into the a room with a bunch of editors? How would it work?
Yeah, I'd sort of keep an eye on everything that was developing during the morning, read the papers, keep an eye on television, and, you know, see what the story of the day was. And then go in about, when I was on air at 5, I used to go in about lunchtime. You'd have a planning meeting with your team, you know, executive producer, chief sub, and a small team of producers. And they'll have been working on it, and they'll have stuff will have been building up during the day through the other programs. Each executive editor would then have a say in kind of how they wanted it for their bit of programming. And then I'd get into the process and we'd sort of kick around ideas if there's any, you know, if we wanted to drive a story forward and thinking about potential guests, could we tell the story a different way? Can we add to it? What are our priorities for our 2-3 hour strand? And I then, once we sort of knew guest lineup, I'd go away and basically research a bit, write, you know, some questions that I thought were going to be appropriate, sort of draw the story out of the various guests, and spend quite a bit of time rewriting some of the intro scripts or whatever, because writing skills and grammar and semantics have slightly slipped in my, and unless it's correct in front of me, it's, you know, you can falter if you're seeing something, and actually what's going on in your head is, why the hell have they used that word? Why have they spelt it wrongly?
Why do you spell 2-T-O or T-W-O when it's exactly. T-O-O?
Well, the apostrophe's gone missing.
Apostrophes must have driven you mad.
Because
does affect the way that you deliver it.
Of course it does. Yeah. And I know I jokingly go in at Christmas and say, look, I've bought you all a lovely bag of apostrophes and we're going to see if we can find a nice place for them in the script. I could see them going, oh, no.
That's also an effect of being professional. And I suppose at the time that you learnt, it was considered to be hugely important. And it was, you know, that idea prevailed.
Mm.
And rightly so, because you don't want to have misunderstandings. And if the language isn't as good as possible, you can...
It's a very simple thing. If you get that wrong, what else have you got
wrong? Right.
Hmm?
And you're in a world where credibility is number one.
Exactly. So if you can't write properly, if you aren't correct about everything you do, why should you be correct about the story itself and whether you've checked it, whether you've told it properly? So... You know, I just think it's a state of mind, it's attitude of work, really,
right.
Being correct.
Now, having live guests can be troublesome, and it can also be very exciting. There must have been guests who disappointed you, and I'm being gentle, and there must have been guests who you just thought were, when you knew that they were going to be on in the show that day, you knew you could just leave it to them, and they'd be able to handle it.
Yeah, no, there's a whole range. The thing I think that people often misunderstand is the purpose of doing an interview. And I think that people think it's, you know, Jeremy Paxman type interviews, you know, Robin Day, it's all about confrontation and conflict. I would say 95% of the interviews you do are you, as a professional, helping somebody to tell their story. They're in there because they've got a story to tell. And it's drawing that story out and getting to tell it well. There's only a small percentage. It's largely politicians and occasionally the odd captain of industry who you know is obfuscating and trying to pull the wool over the public's eyes. And it is your duty to try and get them back on the straight and narrow. So you will have a bit of, you know, argy-bargy. I mean, my view is that there are nice ways to it. You don't have to shout at people. You don't have to lose your rag. And actually, the moment you do that, I think you've lost the public. You've, you know, they're kind of with you. You're their representative. You're asking the questions they'd like to ask of this minister or whatever. So I think it's quite important that you keep calm and try and find ways of. I always remember when the Blair government was in, and you know, Britain first got involved in the awful calamity of Afghanistan, and the defence secretary at the time was a nice Scotsman called John Reid, and very able. And I was told we got John Reid from Afghanistan. He'd gone on his first look-see mission. We got him on the satellite, and he came on with, "Oh, you know, it's all going to be over without a shot being fired. It's all going to be wonderful." And da, 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 da. And he was a director of Celtic Football Club, and so I let him ramble on a bit, and then I said, "You know, Minister or Secretary of State, you're a football man. Can I just ask you, which was the last away team that won in Afghanistan?" And he, because the answer is nobody's ever won in Afghanistan. The Russians didn't.
Not the Russians, not the Americans.
We didn't before. Yep. The Americans haven't won. And centuries back, nobody's won. I mean, it's a...
I think Alexander the Great was the last away game that won.
So it was a way of sort of explaining that people would get, and that he kind of had to laugh. Laugh at his own, you know.
Did you ever lose it with anyone? Was there anyone who annoyed you and was, or perhaps they didn't annoy you? Maybe it was just it went the wrong way, as can happen on live television. Did you ever have a real run-in with someone like the Prime Minister? Or
no, I don't think so. Really, one or two senior politicians and ministers. I would have, you know, in the end. You can be decent about things, but you can't be a nice guy forever. And there are times when you kind of go, "Look, come off it, Minister. We all know that's not really the story, is it? You know, because of this, this, and this." So, yeah, I mean, I think you just try and just give them a gentle nudge.
You don't want to create a scene, because otherwise you're not going to get what you need for the audience, as you said.
No, I mean, some people like that stuff. I mean, in the confrontational
sometimes it's
thing,
good for ratings.
Yeah. The big current affairs shows when you might have a quarter of an hour.
Yeah.
But, I mean, usually...
You were a news show.
Mine was 3, 4, 5 minutes max. So you want to get to the point, get it out of them. Yeah, and do your research well. So you sort of need to know the answer if you're going to ask the question. Mm. Because you need to know when they're not answering straight.
Right.
So that's quite a key thing, but not always easy with politicians.
And access. I mean, you would have been in rooms where the most important decisions had been made, and you would have been in there moments after or even during. You would have had to be in palaces when you would have had to behave in front of members of the royal family, for example.
Yeah. I'm not sure I've stood on too much ceremony at a lot of those things. Royal family, yeah, funny stories. Really. I've done a chapter on the royal family. I think I've sort of explained that it wasn't my all-time favourite thing, traipsing around after the royal family, which I saw as being a rather look-at-life mission. A great old royal correspondent, Tony Carthew at ITN years ago, you know, when I was going off on one of these and saying, "What is the point? You know, why are we here?" And he'd say, dear boy, just look at it like this. He said, "It's a lovely look at life. You go super places. Everybody looks after you really well. And you see some amazing things you never see before." It's true. I've been to Cameroon and Nigeria and
Great Wall of China.
All over the place, yeah. On the Great Wall of China, the Queen's only visit there. And we got a satellite there and went live. And he said, just remember, he said, you go to all these places, take some lovely pictures, and just see the royal family as a cutaway. So in other words, take a shot of them and drop it in every now and then. But other than that, make sure that people have a very nice little travelogue story around the world.
You can't interview the Queen, huh? It's not done. But I saw that she... did some kind of documentary recently on her coronation where she almost allowed herself to be interviewed.
Yes. No, I mean, she's lightened up a bit. She's very good at... The cocktail parties that you get invited to on these royal tours are quite amusing. So the China one, I mean, she was quite, you know, stunned by China, having never been there before. And it was a big moment, 1986 or whatever it was, that she went there. And we flew out this enormous, monstrous satellite dish, which is what you had to do in those days. And then sort of pay the People's Liberation Army a lot of money to borrow a helicopter to get it all shipped up there to the cup. So it was. It was a great piece of television history and a royal history and so on. And back at the guest house, the government guest house, we had a couple of days later, was a cocktail party for the Queen. Mm. And she came up to me and some of the engineers who'd put the dish up and said, "Sir, how did you get it up?" And we all looked a bit taken aback, and then suddenly realised she meant, how did we get the satellite dish on the Great Wall of China? And she was truly fascinated by it. She loved the paraphernalia of telly and the fact that we went to all these ends to get her on telly. She really appreciated it and liked to have a good chat about things. So she was quite accessible. I got to a party when she came here, you know, and I remember walking through Soweto with her and Mandela and me sidling over and saying to him, "How are you?" "Oh, Jeremy, how nice to see you. How's your family?" Usual, polite as ever. And I said, I think all these, do they know who the Queen is? I think they're all here for you. No, they love the Queen. They love the Queen. But I wasn't convinced. I'm not sure half the people knew who the hell the Queen was. But he was the only man, as far as we're aware, global leader, who called her Elizabeth. And she allowed him to.
Yeah.
Nobody else did. I mean, everybody called her Mom, you know, Your Royal Highness. And he'd apparently ring up the bell and say, "Hello, Elizabeth, how are you?" Which was rather sweet. And she was charmed by it. Yeah.
Well, he was a very charming guy. And I sometimes think so diffident, but able to assume the kind of powerful role that he had to when he did. And you mentioned earlier that he got very steely with things like Boy Patong. Mm. But I do think that there are those people who have a tremendous impact on the world. And again, the access that you have as a newsman, you can have conversations with them that are so much more valuable than perhaps the selfie that people might get these days or an autographed book or something. And that's the stuff that I'm glad you wrote a book about, because those are the stories that most people don't have first-hand knowledge and evidence of. It wasn't part of your reports always.
No, not at all. No, sometimes you get to see stuff behind the scenes and talk to people. You know, I think most people are sort of a bit wary, but as you build up a relationship, I think, you know, big figures around the globe, you know, if they get to know you reasonably well, they know the ones that they can trust, that you're not, you know, they can tell you something slightly unguarded and you're not just going to publish it or print it or put it on the telly straight away, that you actually are discreet enough to know what to use and what not to use. So, yeah, it is intriguing. And I think some of the things that I think I've written about with Mandela, I mean, those moments after... of being in Shell House in that news conference with the handful of journalists were there when he walked in, and we pretty much knew what was going to happen, and he announced that he was divorcing Winnie. And you're just a few feet away, so you can see how heavily this is weighing on the man, way more than the pictures would have necessarily conveyed. But you could see he suddenly seemed to age as he sat there telling the story about having to basically take one for the team, give up the love of his life, because he, in the end, was an ANC team man. He always stressed that through and through. And she was bad for business and bad for the team, and the boys had persuaded him, she's got to go, Nelson, and he'd done it. And then just after Harney's assassination, he was obviously fond of Harney, close to him, saw him as a, you know, brilliant young leader who could potentially lead the country. And then just after Harney's assassination, Oliver Tambo, the man that he'd been with side by side when they set up the first black law firm, I think, in Joburg, all those years before, he died within a couple of weeks. And I, right on the off the back of that, I sat down for an interview. And I could see he, you know, he wasn't a broken man, but he wasn't far off. I mean, I just think he'd take such a hit. You know, two of the ablest and best and, you know, two of his biggest political and social friends and supporters and so on going in such quick time. I asked him a question about how he'd been affected by it, and it felt like a lifetime before he answered. I went back and counted it on the tape, and I think it was 8 or 10 seconds. But he just drew breath, and it seemed like the weight of the world was on him. You know, he was mourning. He was grief-stricken by the loss of these people. And to be there, just sitting across, there's just him and me and cameraman and sound recorder, so that's it in a room. It's pretty moving, really. I mean, I tried to convey it in the words around it as well as how he looked, but it's never going to be quite the same on telly as being sitting opposite someone and seeing what's going on in their minds, what's going on in their heart, you know. So quite privileged access to people and quite moving moments watching people deal with stuff. And yet, I mean, I did the whole of the 97 election campaign with Tony Blair, who was a very bright, sharp man and clever and was one of those who was elected on one of what I would call the up wave of optimism, which don't happen very often. Most elections are decided by negatives. This was decided. But I followed him around for 2 months leading up to that election. And at the end of it, I was none the wiser who he was. I always called him the Bar of Soap Man because I could never quite lay my hands on. Just intriguing. There was an element of what he liked to do when he was a student, being an actor, element of the actor about him. He was, you know, a terrific deliverer of speeches and policies and pictures of where they were going, which is good. You need that. You know, I mean, you do need to, any leader needs the people he's trying to lead, whether it be a factory or, the supermarket store or a country. They need to lead people into believing their vision for it. And he was very good at that.
But there seemed to be something a little manufactured about so much of what he did.
Maybe, but the right time.
I mean, the most boring man in the world followed him, Gordon Brown. Easily the most boring man in the whole world.
But that's perceptions, you see, because he was a staggeringly bright man.
Oh, sure.
But not, couldn't portray it, whereas Blair may have been made of different stuff, but could sell it.
Put a good show on.
Yeah. So, talking of upswings, Mandela 94, Blair 97, Obama 2008, positive elections.
Yeah.
Most others are like 2016 in the States, where what I would call lesser evilism comes to bear, where people are faced with two options they don't want, so they go for the lesser of two evils. And in the end, Hillary Clinton sort of lost that election because she wasn't a good campaigner. Yeah. And people held their nose and voted in the end for Trump as marginally.
Did you deliberately choose that as your last proper assignment as a newsman?
No, I'd sort of seen the end of 2016 as a good point to
change direction,
call it a day from full-time news. And I'd done 5 previous American elections, so I was going to do it anyway. And it turned out that it was all about Trump in the end. So it was an extraordinary election to go out with. But, you know, I was saying the positives of election of Obama, who was a wonderful speaker, very charismatic, but couldn't really in the end sell it to Capitol Hill or the public or anything else. You know, in the end he...
Middle America.
Yeah, he couldn't quite get the picture.
Well, it's fascinating to me that you've been so steeped in all of this that we consider current affairs or current history. Because as a student of history, I mean, to me, this stuff matters. And the people who write it down, the chroniclers of our time, as you've used the word once or twice in this discussion, are the ones who determine what that history will be. Because the real facts, you could always argue, are that there is no objective fact. You know, you could always say that everything's subjective to humans because we all take away our own kind of story from it. But I've got to say a big thank you to you for the years that I felt informed by what you'd done and all these many awards that you've won. I mean, you care about the awards?
No, it's nice sort of affirmation from your peers that you may have got something right.
I mean, certainly you've deserved all of them. I mean, even John Reilly, the head of Sky News, said that you were a master of your craft.
Well, which is very nice. And he's a guy I've worked with for on and off for 30 years on a couple of different networks. So when, yeah, in the end, if your peer group believes in you too and thinks you do a good job, and in the end, as the front man, you're kind of selling the team's product. And you know, it's just, in the end, it's just cornflakes, really. It's a different brand of cornflakes. Somebody makes it, somebody prints up the box, somebody puts something inside, and you're the guy that goes out and sells it to people, in a way. I mean, I know it's a crude analogy, but a lot of people put a lot of effort into television news, like they do into radio, huge amounts. The unsung heroes, the people behind the scenes, you know, from the lady who cleans the toilets, the security guy, the sound man, the vision mixers, the engineers.
It's a real operation.
It's big. Yeah. And you just happen to be the sharp end person. That is the end product that people see on air. But a lot of people go into that. So you want to do them all justice. You want to respect the viewer and give them the story as that I believe they deserve to have, presented as balanced and impartial and as fair as possible, as accurate as possible, and you want to do justice to all the people who are actually getting you out on air. I mean, it is, again, a big team effort, and to just think that you're, you know, way, way better than everybody else just because you sit in front of the camera is to misunderstand the premise of television news.
Well, you're the sharpest sharp end. Thank you.
Pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.